latest guest on University Registrars and others talking about stuff is John Rushforth, who is Executive Secretary of the Committee of University Chairs, or CUC, as well as having a number of other sector roles too. John's been around for quite a few years now, and before he joined the newly formed HEFGE back in the day, his early work was with the Audit Commission, where he experienced the challenging days of auditing Liverpool City Council in the 1980s. His memories of HEFGE are strongly positive, and he feels the agency did a difficult job well and was never really captured by the sector, as has been the more recent criticism. From HEFGE, John moved to the University of the West of England before eventually joining CUC as part of a portfolio of not really retirement roles. CUC itself is a small membership organisation, which, along with other sector bodies, plays an important part in the under-recognised area of university governance. John draws an interesting comparison between governing bodies and B-days, before stressing the vital role that chairs play in public advocacy for the value of higher education. Beyond the reputational, regulatory and financial challenges faced by the sector, John notes the additional burden all of this places on unpaid volunteers on governing bodies. Finally, he recounts some of the difficulties he's experienced with some of the more exotic meals he's enjoyed in his various sector roles. It's a really enjoyable discussion with one of the most respected and senior managers in the sector. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars and indeed others talking about stuff. And this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce John Rushforth. And John is an individual with many roles and responsibilities. First among them is Executive Secretary at the Committee of University Chairs, and we'll hear more about that organisation in a minute. He's also works for Advance HE as a consultant in his own right, and also is still on the books at the University of the West of England as a Pro Vice Chancellor. So welcome, John. How do you fit it all in?
It's not as bad as it sounds. I mean, it's great because now, I mean, I formally retired from full-time work 9 years ago. And whilst I'm busy with all the different bits and pieces, the great difference is I have these things called weekends. You probably haven't come across them.
So you nevertheless seem to fill your time with these various different roles. But the CUC one is the kind of core responsibility. Is that fair to say?
That's core, because that's poem. That's about... Formally, that's 2 days a week, but it peaks and troughs. You know, there are times when there's not a lot going on. But when we're in a run-up to plenary or if we've got some big thing that we're trying to do lots of briefings on, that expands. But on average, it's about 2 days a week. I'm probably doing about then a day consultancy on average, but peaks and troughs, you know. Okay. Some weeks really busy. Last week, I was out in Qatar, for example, doing some consultancy work. So that was a whole week out there. That was fun.
Fantastic. Well, we'll come back to CUC in a moment, if we may. But let's talk about how you ended up in this exciting portfolio career post retirement and enjoying your weekends. So, because I think you were, am I right in thinking you originally trained as an accountant? Is that right?
I am of that persuasion. Yes.
I'm not holding it against you.
Yeah, no, it doesn't mean I'm a bad person. But yes, I am a qualified accountant. I trained in local government, in fact.
Right.
At what was then the Soviet Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire. Cheap bus fares and all the rest. Council leader at the time, Clive Betts. But then worked at Avon County Council in local, and then joined Audit Commission, including a spell on Merseyside when Derek Hatton was doing what he was doing. So that was quite exciting.
So what was the Audit Commission?
The Audit Commission was the external auditor of initially local authorities. It used to be called District Audit before then, but it became the Audit Commission. And then it took on the external audit of health authorities as well. It was then disbanded about 10 years ago. It was part of a Thatcher revolution to try and... basically improve and challenge local authorities at the time, because external auditors had the power of surcharge and all that sort of thing. And we were in the period then of Labour councils not setting budgets, militant tendency, all that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that it was an interesting time to be an auditor, to be sure.
So you were auditing Liverpool City Council when Derek Hatton was there and not setting budgets and, as you say, making workers redundant and all that.
It's the only time I've had to leave a meeting with the chief executive because the police rang us up and said we were going to be firebombed. I remember being at presenting a set of audit findings, and good audit. It was, you can spend more on old people's homes if you close down primary schools that are half empty. So quite sensible stuff. I was accused of having the morals of a Nazi war criminal at that point.
Blimey.
So it was pretty heated at times, horrible stuff. I mean, it was nasty. And the audit commission then decided it wanted to break into different markets, and it saw higher education as a possibility. Hefke was just being created. They were looking for somebody to run the audit function. So I took on a 2-year secondment down to Bristol. And I always remember the contrast. My last audit was at Bootle Town Hall. And apologies to anybody from Bootle, but Bootle is not a great place. That my last audit was, I left the car in a car park where my car had been broken into 3 times in 6 months. Made my way across the park where you dodge this hypodermic syringes in the grass. And then as a final sort of farewell to local authorities, not brilliant. Can't roll forward 2 weeks later, 11 o'clock in the morning, sitting in the sunshine, sipping sherry in a chair at Merton College, watching a game of croquet. You think, this is a bit different.
So you made the switch. So you were seconded originally, and then you decided to stick around, did you? Was that how it played out?
Yeah, the audit commission went through a regime change, and the things that I thought would happen to me when I finished this comment weren't on offer. The only thing that was on offer was to go and work in Cardiff, and tempting though that was, I preferred to stay where in the southwest near Bristol. So I asked Graham Davis, and Graham Davis said, yeah, no, we'd love to keep you. So that turned into 13 years and everything from audit to research policy to head of estates, ending up as director of widening participation and deputy director of offer.
Which is, I mean, that's an awful lot to pack into that period. And, so Hefke must have been quite an interesting, I mean, leaving aside the sherry stuff and the croquet, but quite an interesting organization to be a part of, then, because it was kind of still new and different.
I was employee number 12, and it was, what was really interesting about it, you were merging two different cultures. So you'd got for the older members, the UFC joined with the PCFC. The UGC was very much a strong, very strong civil service hierarchical culture. They brought in a wodge of people like me from outside, but also people from institutions as well. And all of that, I think, came together, and we actually created something that felt quite different. A very sort of, and I would say this, I thought it was a really, by the time we got well into it, I thought it was a good organization.
Yeah,
we had a clear sense of values and mission. We cared about the sector. We spent time trying to understand the sector. We got things wrong. Of course we did. And we had, I think people would never say that we were perfect, but I think it was recognized that it was a difficult job and we did the best that we could. But I look back at that time very, very fondly.
And of course it's one of those things that I'm sure my recollection being in different universities and dealing with Hefke wasn't wholly benign, but there's an awful lot of fond nostalgia for Hefke these days, I think, and people realizing what they missed.
Well, like I say, I think our mission was about supporting the sector. And I'm not somebody that subscribes to this idea that we were captured by the sector, because I know in the job that I had in the early stages as auditor, we were pretty fierce with some vice chancellors and some institutions with conditions of grant and people being judicial review and people being forced out of institutions. So that bit of narrative that we were captured somehow doesn't ring true with me. Yeah. But we are actually invested a fair bit of time trying to understand individual institutions. And we'd got a fair number of people that had worked in institutions. And the mix of people that understood the sector, the mix of people coming in from outside that had been doing things differently, I think served the sector quite well.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. And, yeah, it does feel very, very different now. Mm. And we'll maybe come on to talk about that in a moment. But let's continue with your career journey, because you went from Hefke to UWE, is that right?
That's right, yeah. 13 years, you get to the stage where you think the there was one of those moments. And I started saying to my team, when they came up with new ideas, yeah, we tried that 5 years ago. It didn't work then, but I suppose we could give, you know, you think, okay, it's probably time to move on. Howard Newby moved across from chief exec from Hefke and so knew me. He was reorganizing. He wanted to, he'd got another deputy post that he wanted to set up, which was all around property and widening participation and knowledge exchange and all that stuff, which had been a significant part of the brief at Hefke. So I applied and I got it. That was an interesting transition again, because having had 13 years telling universities what to do, suddenly you're in the middle of it and thinking, oh, it's not quite like that, is it? So that was an interesting sort of double take. Again, salutary lesson. When you're in Hefke, you thought, well, we are the center of the world. We're the most important thing that there is. When you're in a university, we were part of the dynamic for sure. But there were lots more important things, like called students, for example, that you had to worry about, you know?
And, of course, happily, it was physically very, very convenient a location.
Yeah, just turn left at the roundabout rather than turn right at the roundabout. So dead easy.
And so you stayed there for quite a few years at UWE, and then as we said, you're technically still on the books, but don't do a huge amount for them these days. And then did you decide to retire and pursue a portfolio career? What was your next sequence?
First, it started off at a point. It was random in that I was approaching 60, but had got no definite clear plans in my mind. I'd got at that point a job with Steve West's encouragement. I took one non-exec job, which was a NHS commissioning group. But then the then chair, Gillian Cam, said, oh, John, could you just help me out here and do a year or so for this thing called CUC? Now, I'd come across CUC at Hefke because I'd been involved with them when they wrote the very original governance code, because my audit, that was in that remit. So I knew roughly what it is, but I said, yeah, okay, I'll pick it up for a year or so. And then, not thinking that that would turn into anything long term, but then government changed rules on pensions, and suddenly I looked at my financial position and thought, not a lot of point keeping working. If I'm going to retire, now's a good time, because the way it worked out, there was a good window to go. And I talked to CUC at that time, saying, well, I'm going to stop being at UWE. There's an option, you can keep me on if you like for a couple of, you know, a day, a week or whatever. Mm. They were up for it and were keen. So it all sort of came together. So I wouldn't say it was planned. It was more sort of opportunities taken that were there. But it worked out really well for me. And it sort of gave me that cushion. I think it gave me that sort of safety net. I knew I'd got something, because I didn't know how. I thought I would do some consultancy, but you never know, you know, if the work will turn up, what it will be like, whether you'll enjoy it, and so on. So that was always part of the plan. So I never thought I would just stop. I thought I couldn't envisage not doing some sort of work, but just exactly the balance of all the different bits that just worked out as it's come along.
Oh, well, that's really good. Well, CUC then, right? I mean, it's an organisation that, you know, some people will be, you know, familiar with, but tell us about CUC as an organisation then, what it does and what you do.
All right. So CUC, first and foremost, a membership organisation. Principal mission is to promote and support the development of good governance in UKHE through supporting the chairs of university governing bodies across the UK. A underlying value is that the strength of the sector lies in its diversity and its autonomous nature, and therefore we accept that there is not one answer to how to govern institutions, but chairs can learn a lot from talking to each other and getting inputs from external people. So we try and support chairs in a range of ways through acting as a sort of learning organisation. And we do that through, first and foremost, we have two plenary sessions where people come together. Typically, we'll get 60 or 70 chairs down at the Royal Society in London for a day or 2 days with a dinner. But guest speakers come in. So we might have chief exec from UK or somebody from the research councils or from OFS or from various experts who are talking about particular topics that are of interest. The chairs will break up into small workshop groups to discuss common problems. And we run active action learning sets as well for new chairs as they make that transition from the outside world into being a chair to explore common problems. And the common problems are common. How do you manage difficult vice chancellors? What's your role in academic governance? How do you recruit a diverse board? All those things continuously being explored all the time. We also produce guidance, whether it's the HE Code of Governance, Audit Committee Chair's guidance, or the Senior Remuneration guidance for senior staff. And we can talk about how those come about if you like. We provide comparative data. So we do the most comprehensive annual survey of Vice Chancellor's pay terms and conditions. That's then made freely available to all chairs on a confidential basis so they can compare and contrast. And we, from time to time, provide a sort of informal support. So if a chair has a particular issue, he or she can either contact me for an informal chat, or I'll put them in touch with another chair that's faced a similar problem. So it's very much a sort of mutual support network type thing. All of that is coupled with a sort of influencing role. So we try and stay connected to a range of stakeholders, whether it's DfE, OFS, research councils, USEA. We have a number of strong partnerships with AHUA, with Advance HE, all trying to share ideas, concerns, worries, so everybody knows what everybody else is doing. We try and collaborate wherever we can. We are a small organisation. There's basically 2.5 of us. There's me part-time. I've got one full-time officer, Amanda, and 2 other part-time people that do events and finance. So it's small, but we rely on our partnerships and working with other people to deliver what we do.
Wow. I mean, that is small. And I think CUC does a lot given that limited resource. But those partnerships are really important because, it seems to me that, you know, CUC does occupy a really important place in the higher education landscape in the UK, in that, you know, governance generally little understood part of what universities have in place, and because it's not seen by the vast majority of
staff or indeed students who work in and study in universities. And it's, so it's invisible to lots of people, apart from a very, very small group, usually in executive positions at the top. But the role that chairs of governing bodies and governing bodies themselves plays is so important in terms of the long-term success of universities. And having that kind of connections across the sector is really important, so that no governing body, no chair is acting purely on their own, dealing with their difficult vice chancellor or whatever, and that they've got a network, but they've also got a support framework, including the guides, as you described, but these other events and other activities. And I just think that's hugely important, given the importance of these governing bodies within our universities and within the sector. It is a really critical function, I think.
Yeah. I'm afraid it reminds me in part of the old joke, why is a governing body like a B-Day? Nobody knows what they're quite there for, but everybody agrees they give the place a touch of class. But anyway.
I have not heard that one before, John, and I won't be relating it to my university's council anytime soon. But I mean, there is an interesting point there, because actually your chairs of governing bodies of university councils do tend to be, you know, very much in the category of what you describe as the great and the good, don't they? I mean, yeah. They are, you know, they're big hitters.
Last time I looked at it, we've got about 60 to 70% would be chief execs of corporate interest. We've probably got about 20% sort of chief execs or significant executives from big public sector institutions like NHS trusts and so on. We've got very few academics, a couple, but not many, a sprinkling of civil service, a few bishops, ex-head of MI5. So a whole range of sort of people. And that's what makes CUC gatherings so interesting, because you've got all these diverse opinions and views of people. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that CUC can bring. And I think we've got to use it more. I mean, you know that one of the challenges we all face now is the reputation and the public perception of universities is not where we want it to be. We have had a battering over the years for various reasons, which we can talk about if you like. But what one of the things that CUC can bring, and it's a challenge to me and my members, and we have to get better at it, is I think we've got to try and use chairs to stand up and speak about the sector, because then they know the sector, but they're not as in the sector as, say, a vice chancellor or a registrar is. And also they've got these fantastic networks that they've all got. And if people outside of HE are saying positive things about us, that's much more credible than if we stand up and say we're really great, but we need more money.
I completely agree, John, and I think that's absolutely a really valuable role that members of CUC could really play. We know that there are these hugely impressive individuals, as you say, with their networks, who are highly respected in their own right, who could be fantastic public advocates for the importance of higher education, both in terms of, you know, the graduates we produce and the research and knowledge exchange, civic partnerships, international profile, all the rest of it. And the sector really needs it, doesn't it? I mean, we on the one hand, we did marvelous things during the pandemic in terms of, you know, vaccines, etc., and students in the front line, healthcare professionals, all the rest of it. But our standing in many ways is very, very low in terms of public perception. It looks like we're just paying people large sums of money.
Yeah, why we've invested with the UK in the work that Britain Thinks has been doing. Looking at public perception, and a session with the UK earlier this week about how we're going to build on that work. And I think some of the insights that come, they're not enormously surprising, but it's a good reality check. You know, the average member of the public might know that we produce graduates, but some know something about research. The thing that probably surprised me is how little people knew about the impact and what we do in our local communities. So I think there are some real opportunities for us to really focus on that a bit more going forward. And we're clear, CUC will play its part in that.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good to hear. One of the other areas which we touched on briefly is around so on the one hand, you've got the kind of the story, the reputation, the positioning of higher education. And then you've got the landscape in which we're operating, right, which is feels to many of us working in universities as ever more constrained and challenged. And that's not just reputationally, but it's bureaucratically, it's regulatory. And I mean, is there a role for CUC in helping to push back against some of that, particularly the most challenging stuff that we're seeing around, you know, kind of international partnerships or around some aspects of free speech? What about those kind of things? Do you think CUC has a role to play there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we already have worked with UUK on the free speech thing, and we were helped draft and were co-signatories to the statement that UUK put out on free speech. And for all of these topics that flare up from time to time, part of what we do is run specific briefing sessions for the members to make sure they're briefed and they understand so they can articulate and deal with the topics as they come up and just, I think, respond appropriately for their institution. But the other thing we do is trying to deploy our expertise. So on the regulatory front, for example, UUK and I have talked about some work that UUK initiated, which is they're going to run a workshop in March on what makes good regulation in HE.
Right.
And what we are offering to them is at least two chairs who have been regulators in other fields who will come along and talk about their experience. And again, that will be quite an authoritative voice on what good regulation looks like. And again, it's interesting. And you can look at any number of topics that HE has to deal with, and I can usually find some chairs that have had some input. So when we had a whole set of discussions about USS, I could pull together, you know, first the ex-president of the Actuaries Association, plus a couple of people that run some of the biggest pension funds in the country. That then gives us an expert group that actually UUK found really helpful as it was thinking through what it was going to do. But then we can brief chairs, because fantastic though some of the stuff UUK does, its audience typically is people in HE, vice chancellors are immersed in it. Our job in part is to take these issues and focus it down to the bits that governors and chairs need to focus on, because I'm always very conscious one of the challenges for us is to help chairs understand the bit that's and other people the bit that's for chairs and governing bodies without dragging them into all the executive stuff and all the detail. Some of the guides that enthusiasts sometimes want to put out to boards have way too much stuff in it, and you've got to try and extract it out to what are the actual governance points, what's the strategy issue that governors have got to focus on. Don't get them involved in all the detail, because that's executive's job.
I absolutely, but I mean, again, you put the example of pensions, which is a particularly thorny issue and has been for a couple of decades in the sector. But it is one of those areas where, you know, where governing bodies and chairs of governing bodies can add value, as you say, is both that expertise, but also looking at things from a very high level and looking at things for the long term as well. Right. So not being drawn into the particular issues around the particular dispute that's going on at the moment, but actually trying to think of the big picture stuff and offer advice and counsel in relation to the longer term thing. Because, you know, if the whole pensions thing falls apart, then that's an existential crisis for our sector, which is, you know, would be disastrous. Right. So we do need to make sure that we somehow navigate through the current travails and then actually have a coherent long-term plan for our institutions and their staff and their futures, do we not? I mean, one of the things about Hefke is it was very much an English funding council, and we had comparable institutions in the other UK nations, right? Since that time, you know, we've had further devolution, arguably further diversion and fragmentation within the HE sector in the UK. But CUC is very much a UK wide body, and I wondered if there's how you kind of deal with the divergence challenge within CUC?
We deal with it by groupings. So we recognise that there is a specific group of the Welsh chairs meet independently and are supported by us. The Scottish chairs meet independently and talk to us. So, for example, they're I think in the middle, or they're getting towards rewriting their code of governance up in Scotland, but they share a draft with us, and I've given Jim some comments on those. So we communicate with that, and then we come together as an entity, and we always make sure that whenever we have our plenary sessions, the brief always to speakers, and some follow their brief and some don't, is remember this is a UK institution.
Yeah.
It gets problematic sometimes, and OFS is the obvious example, because they are an English regulator. But they're still of interest but we check with our Scots and our Welsh members, and they are interested, because what OFS does to institutions is likely to have some sort of impact, either to the regulators in those countries who look and see and think about, but equally its impacts on English institutions, particularly those near the border, can affect cross flows directly. So we try and we're conscious of it, and we recognize it, and we celebrate it, and we connect with it, and it's okay. But like I say, the commonalities are so much more than the differences, because they've all got difficult vice chancellors, awkward registrars, too much regulation, not too many acronyms in the briefing papers, and so on.
Yeah, I think the acronyms point is very well made. We all get that complaint. What about the biggest challenges then facing the sector from your perspective? I mean, you've been around for a long time, you've seen it all, but what do you see as the biggest challenges coming down the track towards us?
I think the biggest challenge at the moment is the reputation one, because I think that's the hardest thing to shift. I really do worry. I mean, there's always been anxiety about funding, always.
Yeah.
Even in the days post 97, when actually we got significant shed loads of money coming in, even then there was a worry it wasn't enough to do all the things we wanted and could do and were expected to do. But what really troubles me on the financial front is you have a range of things that just seem to make it more and more difficult, and I can't quite see a way through. So we have a student funding system that is not fit for purpose. We have a political environment that looks at that and says, oh, that's too difficult to deal with. So there's no clear plan or suggestion actually yet. And yet we cannot go on with fixed, year-on-year reductions in real-term funding. Yeah. And the real concern is we'll have a classic infrastructure failure, in as much as things will get gradually a little bit worse each year, and then there will suddenly be a catastrophic failure of some sort, and we will lose a tranche of institutions. That's what I really worry about. It's exacerbated by some of the political rhetoric about one of the saving balances we've got is our international connections and our ability to work internationally. And yet we've got some government policies that seem to be counter that some of the time not. So there's that whole uncertainty and complexity. I think there is, on the governance side, a regulatory issue that we've got to think hard about, which is the burden on what is still predominantly a volunteer operation, the great and the good that give up their time. And increasingly, people of that ilk do have portfolio careers. So the idea that you retire and just live off your pension, not a lot of people do that these days. People have got portfolio careers and they see other things that they can do. They can pick up a directorship in the health service or somewhere else, and they'll get a modest stipend out of it, contribution. Yep.
But
overwhelmingly, we rely on unpaid. There's some movement, but not a lot.
Yeah.
And yet the expectation keeps on ramping up, and the quantity of ball papers keeps going up, and the expectation of what they will get engaged in keeps on going up.
Mm.
And at some point, that volunteer system may not be sustainable. I don't think we're there yet, but that's a sort of more medium-term anxiety.
Yeah, no, absolutely get that. That has all been absolutely fascinating, John. I one last question for you, if I may, which is, you, without wishing to cast aspersions about it, but you've seen many different facets of our
sector. I am very old. It's all right.
Yeah, you are old, right? But you are august as well, and senior and respected figure. But you've seen a lot, right? So is there anything that you particularly recall as something, amusing or strange about higher education that particularly tickles your fancy that you'd like to share?
It's more memorable than strange, and it's that context thing. I've already referred to the cultural change of coming into HE where you drink sherry rather than worry about having a cup of tea. But the first time I had lunch at Nottingham University in Colin Campbell's day, expecting to make sandwiches. And he pressed a bell, and a fully dressed butler with gloves came on. And it was just, what? To go on a trip, a university trip to Japan for British Council. And we all split up to different places. And I was in a lunch and I was the guest of honour, which is great. They bring I have not got a clue what is being presented to me. So I pick something up. Everybody waits for me to go first as honoured guest. So I pick something up. Put it in my mouth, say, oh, this is lovely, or symbolise that. Everybody looks at me oddly, picks up exactly the same thing, peels it properly, and then eats it. And that continues, that sort of difference and experience and privilege in many ways. So going to Qatar a couple of weeks ago, invited out to dinner to somebody's house, who turns out to be the cousin of the cousin of the emir. So the feast that we have starts with each of our plates had a whole leg of lamb on it. It then moved on to eating roast camel, including camel heart. And we ended up being given your own whole roast sheep's head with teeth, eyes and everything to select from.
Ooh.
So, experiences and memories, lots of. But my goodness, what a privilege to work in a sector full of interesting people doing interesting things, caring about their students, random research projects. My favourite, radioactive lettuce. Okay, a project at UWE which was looking at growing lettuce, which soaked up radioactivity out of the ground at places like Chernobyl and all the rest of it. You can then burn the lettuce. And it concentrates the radioactive crap, which means you need much less landfill. What
sounds pretty good to me.
Get stuff like that in.
That's fantastic. John, we need to stop there. But listen, thank you ever so much for talking about your career and about CUC and also about those great recollections of your time in higher education. It's been lovely to talk to you. But thanks ever so much.
My pleasure, indeed.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.